Rising political tensions between Caracas and Madrid, Maduro denounced recent hostile actions from the Spanish government of Pedro Sanchez, including the Spanish Foreign Minister Arancha Gonzalez, who last Saturday visited the border between Colombia and Venezuela and criticized the situation of Venezuelan migrants in the zone. The visit by the top Spaniard diplomat in Colombia was strongly decried by Maduro, saying that Spain must stay away from his country's internal issues.
I condemn Spain's meddling actions. Such a mistaken conduct will be punished by my administration.
Meanwhile, on the opposition side, many backed the Spanish move, alleging the European country must intervene in Venezuela's problems.
Spain's speaking in favor of Venezuelan migrants who flee our homeland due to Maduro's failed regime.
However, Venezuelan officials insist the Spanish move is politically motivated and therefore will not be tolerated.
Spain and the European Union must rectify their hostile political stance on Venezuela, or else relations will break up.
Maduro has remarked that relations with Spain in all areas will be fully examined by him, as the Spanish meddling in Venezuela's affairs is unacceptable. He blames Madrid over imitating the U.S. hostility and claims Venezuela will respond accordingly. Asociación de Caracas.
Lab rats have always been used as guinea pigs for testing brand new medicine. But when it comes to the coronavirus, the story is different. Mice cannot be infected with the coronavirus, since they do not have the receptor that hosts the virus. To scientists, however, there's always a way. Iran's Royan Institute, which specializes in biomedical and stem cell research, has created transgenic mice with a human receptor on their cells. The receptor, called ACE2, is the one that the coronavirus uses to make its way into human cells. This means the genetically modified mice can now catch the virus.
We transferred a human version of this receptor called ACE2 to the mice, and now our transgenic mice can basically get the virus, can get the disease COVID-19, and they are a good model for the basically studies that aim to investigate the drugs, medical procedures.
The transgenic mice can be used to understand unexpected clinical manifestations of the coronavirus infection in humans.
It will be useful for those aspects of COVID-19 which are basically more or less unknown right now. And we hope that it will uncover more details about the disease process itself. And also, it will be useful for other possible new types of coronavirus, which may appear in future years.
Experts at Royan Institute say the mice can also be used as a viable stand-in for humans in testing potential vaccines and therapeutics.
Basically, any types of vaccine which is proposed for this specific disease can be used on these mice. So we are providing these mice for other researchers in the country to use it before they try it on human, and they can get more information from the mice, because you can easily dissect mice and see what's happening inside the bodies, the organs. You can't do that with human, right?
Royan Institute is currently developing its own COVID vaccine. The preclinical stages will involve testing the vaccine on the genetically modified mice. Royan's vaccine is one of the 8 jabs Iran is developing. 2 of them have so far made their way to the human trial phase. Since the virus struck in Iran, Royan Institute has stepped in to join the fight against COVID-19 by mass-producing test kits. And now that its vaccine is lagging behind in the race with its domestic rivals, the leading biotech firm says lab results show that the vaccine is a promising candidate. It will soon enter the animal trial phase. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
The U.S. has finally released a long-awaited report on the gruesome murder of Jamal Khashoggi, confirming that the Crown Prince had personally approved an operation to capture or kill him. Accordingly, the U.S. says it has imposed sanctions against Saudi Arabia over the murder, However, Washington's restrictions only target members of the Saudi Royal Guard's Rapid Intervention Force, not their patron and commander, Mohammed bin Salman. That once again exposes Washington's double standard in dealing with criminals, despite its own intelligence assessment that Khashoggi was killed and his body dismembered at the behest of bin Salman in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul in 2018. The UN has reacted to the CIA report, saying the U.S. fails to take practical steps to hold the main culprit accountable.
With the release of the U.S. report confirming Saudi officials' culpability at the highest levels, the United States should now take the lead in ensuring accountability for this crime and for setting in place the international mechanisms to prevent and punish such acts in the future. The United States government should impose sanctions against the Crown Prince as it has done for the other perpetrators, targeting his personal assets but also his international engagements.
Reactions are also pouring in from other authorities and legal experts who have dismissed the U.S. report as too little, too late.
This is not enough. The Crown Prince needs to face accountability. He needs to face sanctions, asset freezes, travel bans.
Analysts are also criticizing the White House for failing to take the Saudi Crown Prince to account.
Nobody saw the actual report until now, and yes, it's confirmed that indeed, as the Saudis say, a rogue operative was responsible, and that rogue is bin Salman himself.
Many believe Washington's failure to hold bin Salman accountable is due to its interests. Even the U.S. itself has admitted that it is seeking its own interests in maintaining a close partnership with Riyadh.
I would say the relationship with Saudi Arabia is an important one. We have significant ongoing interests. We remain committed to the defense of the kingdom. And so what we've done by the actions that we've taken is really not to rupture the relationship, but to recalibrate it.
In fact, decades-old U.S.-Saudi nexus have benefited the both, with Riyadh spending its petrodollars for American arms and Washington hatching plots to destabilize the region for its own sake. The U.S. backing for the Saudi regime's deadly mayhem in Yemen over the past 5 years is part of such plots. If the new U.S. administration claims that it really wants to break with the policies of the Trump government, it should walk the walk rather than talk the talk and stop supporting the al-Saud regime that has a long history of malign disregard for not only its own citizens like Khashoggi, but even the impoverished people like Yemenis.
The racial disparities in who gets a dose of the desperately wanted coronavirus vaccine continues to roil the United States. African Americans compose 12% of the U.S. population, yet they have only received 5% of the vaccines. 60% of America is white, and they have gotten 60% of the vaccines. The mainstream media is repeatedly blaming the problem on African Americans by emphasizing their mistrust of the federal government due to a shocking national history of medical experimentation on black communities. However, the small share of whites and blacks who say they refuse to ever get vaccinated is the same, 14%. Multiple studies point to a simpler explanation. Vaccines are overwhelmingly being sent to white neighborhoods. In the United States, vaccines are being issued at places like pharmacies, clinics, and hospitals. But perpetual underinvestment in lower class and non-white areas means many black communities simply don't have this medical infrastructure. Similarly, African American and poor neighborhoods don't have adequate schools, roads, businesses, work opportunities, and many other basic requirements for healthy living. Since almost the start of the pandemic, it's been clear that non-whites are drastically overrepresented in the so-called essential worker occupations, and that non-whites are 4 times more likely to be hospitalized by corona and 3 times more likely to die from it.
And then we also have a lot of our Southside hospitals that are closing and can't meet the demand if they were to get the shipments. They don't have anywhere to store them. So that's another reason. A lot of our clinics are being closed in the inner community. It's time to get the boots on the ground. It's time to show face by coming into the black communities, setting up pop-up shops for vaccines.
Latino Americans are getting only 11% of vaccines, despite being 18% of the population. The failure to equally share coronavirus vaccines with all classes is expected to further exacerbate the nation's long-standing socioeconomic inequalities, which the pandemic continues to reveal. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Researchers say sharks eat grazing animals that feed on aquatic plants like seagrass, which helps maintain water clarity, stores carbon dioxide, and houses fish and other organisms that can keep seas healthy. We now present you an article written by Howard Cohen. The piece is titled "Study Finds Sharks Can Help Marine Ecosystems Survive Effects of Climate Change." The article has been taken from the BangorDailyNews.com website. Please stay with us for more of Howard Cohen's article. When a major hurricane, extreme heat or other climate threat devastates an ocean's lifeblood, its recovery could be aided by the presence of sharks. Sharks as oceanic medics. That's the idea behind a study on sharks and their role in the ocean. The study, led by researchers at Florida International University, FIU, was published in the Journal of Animal Ecology. The Florida International University scientists said, "Decimate sharks and you've made oceans less resilient to extreme climate events." Researchers at the University of Washington and Deakin University in Victoria, Australia also contributed to the new research study. The study was conducted from May 2013 through to August of 2014 and funded through a combination of National Science Foundation Rapid Response Grant and fellowship awards and public donations. The team included lead author Rob Nowicki, a research affiliate at Sarasota Moat Marine Laboratory. He was joined by co-author Mike Heithaus, a marine ecologist and dean of Florida International University's College of Arts, Sciences and Education. And Florida International University seagrass expert, James Forkeran. The team found that predators, like some sharks, including tiger sharks in this study, are critical for maintaining stability and biodiversity in the world's oceans. The study found sharks are important in helping ecosystems recover when devastation hits from hurricanes or marine heat waves. The researchers say sharks eat grazing animals that feed on aquatic plants like seagrass, which helps maintain water clarity, stores carbon dioxide, and houses fish and other organisms that can keep the seas healthy. To reach its conclusion, the team conducted a 16-month study in Shark Bay, Australia, an area populated by tiger sharks and dugongs, a cousin of the Florida manatee. Dugongs are strictly marine animals, whereas manatees can thrive in freshwater areas. The study said grazing animals, including turtles and dugongs, eat seagrass. Sharks eat the grazers. Grazers fear the sharks, so when sharks are around, the grazers often avoid the area. While the grazers are away, the aquatic plants have time to grow and recover. When an extreme climate event strikes, the ecosystem must deal with a whole new set of variables that require time to recover. Shark Bay was selected because a historic heat wave had decimated much of the bay's seagrass canopy in 2011. Researchers found recovery was slow, but was aided by the seasonal presence of sharks. The grazers feed on shallow seagrass meadows, but swim to deeper waters until sharks leave in winter. But the 2011 heat wave destroyed much of the shallow seagrass canopy, and the dugongs munched much of what was left. Researchers wanted to know what would happen if the sharks didn't return during the summer months and the dugongs had free rein to eat up the grass. In April and May 2013, the team placed 30 experimental plots, 2 to 3 meters deep, in two seagrass banks in Shark Bay. Florida International University reported by using previous calculations of how many dugongs were around and how much they ate, researchers were able to mimic the way dugongs feed on the seagrass in the summer months and what it would be like if there was no sharks around. Florida International University said in a news release, their experiment left the area with no recovery time, meaning if the dugongs grazed year-round, they'd end up inadvertently destroying the critically important seagrass canopy. The research shows that when top predators are gone, not only does the structure of the ecosystem break down, but it's also all but impossible for the ecosystem to stage a comeback. The lead author of the new research, Nowicki, said in a statement, "One of the reasons we did this study is because we think it's important to be thinking about how everything is linked, and sometimes those linkages are surprising," he added. But they show climate resilience is not something that happens on its own. It happens in conjunction with species conservation. Co-author of the report, Heithaus, added, "Every ecosystem on the planet depends on a delicate balance of relationships. The findings fulfill one of the study's goals to keep the links linked, meaning conserving predators and prey." Nowicki said, "Ultimately, to rein in climatic extremes that are becoming more common and intense, we know we need to cut carbon dioxide emissions and carbon production, but that's going to take time," adding, "It's almost like we're on a leaky boat with a hole. We need to fix the boat at some point, but in the meantime, we can grab a bucket and get the water out. That's kind of what we're doing here. We're making the case that protecting predator species and keeping these species' relationships can actually lead to resilience to these events. It can buy us time, and we need as much time as we can get.
The debate.
Hello and a warm welcome to the debate. I'm Behrouz Najafi. Washington has placed sanctions on several Russian officials over what it alleges to be the chemical poisoning of opposition figure Alexei Navalny. These are the first sanctions to target Russia since Biden took the helm at the White House. Joe Biden says that the U.S. will no longer be, quote, rolling over in the face of what he calls aggressive action by Russia. The European Union already restricted travel and froze the assets of six Russians in October, and this week's sanctions will be the first under the EU's new human rights regime. How effective a punishment could the sanctions prove to be? How would relations between Russia and the West be impacted?
Relations between Moscow and Washington are deteriorating over the imprisonment and alleged poisoning of Russian opposition figure Alexei Navalny. The U.S. has imposed sanctions on several Russian individuals and entities over the case. It accused the Kremlin of being behind the poisoning and renewed demands for Navalny's release. Washington says the move was taken in coordination with the European Union, which has already sanctioned four senior Russian justice and law enforcement officials. Prior to the U.S. announcement, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov had warned that his country will respond to Washington's sanctions proportionately.
We will respond without fail. Reciprocity is one of the rules of diplomacy. We have repeatedly said what we think of illegitimate unilateral sanctions. The American colleagues, as well as the European Union that follows the US lead, tend to resort to, for practically no reason. When they have nothing to say to back the allegations about Navalny's poisoning, they begin to punish us. I think it does no credit to anyone who takes such decisions.
Analysts believe that the US and its European allies are politicizing the case and are interfering in Russia's internal affairs.
This is an obvious case of blatant meddling in the internal affairs of the Russian Federation. And they have the European Court of so-called Human Rights has not given any justification except for political talk for why they made this decision.
Navalny was rushed to a local hospital in the Siberian city of Omsk on August 20th after collapsing on a Moscow-bound flight. He fell into a coma and was put on a ventilator in an intensive care unit. 2 days later, he was airlifted to Berlin for treatment. On September 2nd, Berlin claimed that German government toxicologists, after examining Navalny's test samples, concluded that he had been affected by a toxic agent belonging to the Novichok family. Moscow denied any involvement, saying it has been no proof Navalny was poisoned. It also said that Russian doctors detected no poisonous substance in Navalny's system prior to his transfer to Berlin. The Kremlin critic was arrested in January upon his return from Germany. Last month, a Russian court gave him 2.5 years in jail for violating a 2014 parole. The relations between Russia and the West have been thorny over a host of issues. Their ties deteriorated due to various sanctions imposed over Russia, citing its involvement in the crisis in eastern Ukraine and alleged interference in the 2016 U.S. presidential election. The latest pretext to target Russia by the U.S. and its allies threatened to take the relationship to a new low and fuel tensions further.
Okay, that was the report by Matthew Fetterman. Let's get down to business. Joining me in this debate show will be veteran journalist and political activist Krista Forstel from Berlin, and also a lecturer with Brown University, Vladimir Goldstein, who's joining us out of Rhode Island. Good to have both of you, gentlemen. Let's go to Berlin first. Krista, the Kremlin argues that the new U.S. sanctions over the Navalny case would be futile and would only exacerbate the already strained relations. Do you think the sanctions could achieve their goal?
Not at all. Of course, not at all. To my best understanding, Navalny is taking his steps following Khodorkovsky, who was once the richest man in Russia. The helm went from Khodorkovsky to Navalny in 2017, in April, when Khodorkovsky was the person who asked the Russian people to vote for Navalny. And Navalny, to my best understanding, is a CIA and BND Bundesnachrichtendienst agent. This is his behavior. This is his financing. This is the support he had when he was in Germany and for months very active, instead of, you know, fulfilling his parole in Russia to make a very strange and hectic anti-Putin movie which failed to do the trick.
Now let's turn to Rhode Island. Vladimir, what's the reason making Biden's push for tougher measures against Moscow? You know, the previous administration did not take action regarding this case.
Well, Biden basically wants to reassert United States versus Russia, and he uses this Navalny case as a pretext to rally allies, to rally Europeans, to rally United States, to say that we United States are back in the driving seat. We're going to define the good behavior, we're going to define bad behavior, we're going to define the sanctions, and we have to follow. That's kind of, and that's something which President Trump didn't do. So Biden basically, this is a message to European allies that we are back in business. How effective it's going to be, how credible it is, it's not credible at all, it's not effective, because we know, first of all, EU do not have any unity. There is like Eastern Europeans who scream for sanctions. This is their main reason for existence. It's like sanctions against Russia. Russia is a threat. You know, all the European countries, including Germany, are not that fascinated with it. They want to have this relationship. United States people want to have relationship. So the whole thing is kind of divided inside, but on the surface of it, Biden wants to project the aura of unity, of working and consolidation. So I would say the sanctions are largely symbolic, and they are not particularly serious. So the very fact that they take top people in Russian government, which deals with security and prison and so on, and take away their visas, it's kind of rather symbolic, and I'm sure Russia will do the same. But it sends a message to European allies that we are in charge and we're together, we're backing, and we want to work in unison. So that's a typical thing. Nobody should expect anything particularly interesting from Biden. He will try to sort of go on with the traditional sort of policies, that's all.
Now, Krzysztof, the Kremlin insists that this is a domestic issue and considers other countries' comments and measures against it as interference. How do you look at the issue?
Yeah, I think, unfortunately, Russia is right, very much right in this case. It is a video which was published that the MI6 was meeting a friend of Navalny in Moscow. And that friend was asking for $10 to $20 million per year to the so-called opposition, and that would help that opposition. And that friend also asked for MI6 intelligence on corruption in Russia, which then Navalny would sell in the public as his research. and then accuse Russian officials of corruption. Of course, there is corruption. That's correct. And of course, that must be attacked. Correct. But who, as a credible opposition figure, would go to a foreign secret service? I have never done this in my whole life, and I have a lot of corruption to, you know, talk about in Germany, and then ask a foreign secret service for financial assistance through his friend. This is outright crazy, and it is better for everybody not involved, non-Russian, to keep his dirty fingers out of this dirty game. It has nothing to do with a credible opposition in Russia, which is necessary because we have many, you know, difficult situations and problems in Russia, but please not this way. That is one thing. And the sanction, you know, the most interesting game is now being played about the Nord Stream 2 double tube gas pipeline project in the Eastern Sea. And that is something so vital for Germany and Europe, and not as vital for Russia, by the way, because they have this huge Chinese market to care for. But one thing is clear, Washington is trying its level best to stop this project in the last second. They cannot succeed, and that is the real game behind the scenes, and obviously the sanctions now being declared about Russia, that's just, you know, a little game. That's nothing really serious. And it's, of course, something where Russia, which is a very diplomatic, guided country, that they can easily re-prosecute because, of course, this is little stuff. That is peanuts, so to say. The big thing is the Nord Stream 2 project, and that is being, you know, fought about right now behind closed doors.
Right. And, Vladimir, why should the West, particularly the United States, show so much concern regarding Navalny's case and threaten Russia with sanctions? Are they really worried about freedoms and rights violations?
Yeah, not... Are you
asking
me?
Not at all.
Vladimir, please.
Had they been worried about it, they would have been, you know, worried about such cases like Julian Assange and so on. This is a pretext, and I would say it's a red herring. That's what we have to remember. That the United States experiences a really serious crisis of identity. They don't know where they're going. They don't know how to solve. And it's a very simple thing. Blaming Russia, trying to find a pretext, even though, you know, if you look inside the country, there's a tremendous amount of problems, from policemen running around loose, killing people, to, you know, economy in a bad shape, and so on. So what in my country, he isn't seen growing up there as a teenager. Every time we hear from the decrepit Brezhnev regime, oh, how bad it is in the United States, and there is this prisoner, Angela Davis, who was a professor at Berkeley, who was arrested, and we demand her freedom, and we want to do sanctions. So this is, and we know where Brezhnev regime ended. So for me, this is a repeat, a replay, a lack of vision, lack of strategy, lack of policy, and just, you know, giving population the semblance that we're going through some motions, we're doing some sanctions, we're tough, we're not like Trump, we're going to show Russia. But it's just basically for domestic consumption, and of course we know that the enemy which is on decline is dangerous. So Russia shouldn't relax, China shouldn't relax, Iran shouldn't relax. But basically, you know, this is a very good sign of decline of United States and their vision and policy.
Right. Okay, Christoph, go ahead with your comments. Do you share the same view?
Yes, quite so, very, very obviously. If Joe Biden thinks he's getting into business now with this kind of little nonsense, he's in fact kicking himself and his good nation out of it. That is a very sorry state. Donald Trump was, from the start, very open towards truly, I mean really, truly, factually improving relations between the US and Russia. That was a very, very good goal to have, and deep state did not allow him. What is this? An American president in his tenure is inviting an important foreign leader like Vladimir Putin twice to the White House, and he was not allowed to pull through. Putin was not allowed to visit Washington, visit Donald Trump in the White House. Donald Trump wanted to improve the relations even as a candidate for the presidency, and then had to wait for 1.5 years to pull through with this meeting. And you know what happened, this kind of witch hunt, he very correctly stated about his Russia relation and how he waited for such a long time, and then he spent, which is not allowed obviously for a US president because he might sell his country, crazy accusation, 2 hours without witnesses with the Russian president, and nobody was allowed to be there. And the rumors which were then being spread by the cartel media, the big deep state owned American media, who accused Trump not to be a reliable patriotic president. How crazy is this? This was a very patriotic president who did a very sensible thing. That means he went to the next big power and said, let's sit together, let's talk, let's find commune ways for the future. And that was very important, that was very political, and Joe Biden has nothing of this. I'm very, very, you know, deeply concerned that our American friends are in such a ridiculous kindergarten way, kicking themselves out of politics in the way they behave towards Russia. That is so stupid. And it will not, of course, succeed due to a very simple fact. We have two fantastic foreign policy managers in Moscow right now. One is this wonderful Foreign Minister Lavrov, and the other one is Vladimir Putin himself, who speaks fantastic fluid German. And this is something which we have to keep in mind. These guys will outlive any stupid Western approach. Does it come now from Washington or from Paris or from Berlin? Doesn't matter. They will outlive that until European people right now will try to liberate themselves from this disgusting kind of, you know, governments which are always disturbing intelligent and good steps towards peace and cooperation in the world. This is the fact we have right now. It's a very sorry state for Washington.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, Vladimir, to what extent could the Navalny case dent Moscow-Washington's relationship? Because, you know, the relations are already tense.
Yeah, they are tense, and I don't think Russians expected much of the improvement, but I think, you know, so far, not like drastic change. I think, as I said, they're going, Biden goes through symbolic gestures. Saying that he's not going to be like Trump. This is very important for his voter base, that he's not going to be as Trump. He sends a message to Europeans that will try to work as previous Obama administration did. So that's symbolic. I don't think he did anything very drastic. For example, despite Eastern Europeans' demands to do something about Nord Stream, he didn't do anything. So in other words, it's symbolic gestures. I don't think you know, his heart himself is into that. He uses it as a smokescreen, as a red herring, and he has some visions of domestic policy, and that's what you have to do. But you know, I would also add that, you know, they poison attitudes and relationship. There is a time where in 21st century, time to revision Russia U.S. relationship, U.S.-European relationship, even time to revision EU constituency. Why EU has to have these strange countries there, which is, they don't have Russia, which is like integral part of Europe, and they have all these, the Baltic states, which is, or Ukraine, who, or not Ukraine, or sort of Baltic states, Romania, Bulgaria, whom they turn into, you know, their vassals. And, you know, this is kind of not a valuable body, political body. So EU is kind of eroding. United States-EU relationship are kind of falling apart. So that's what they have to revisit first and bring Russia on, you know, because any decision which is related to the world, to Europe, has to involve Russia. So why not somehow United States talk to European countries like, you know, Baltic states or Poland, but not to Russia, and think they're going to solve anything. It's just all thinking, all politics, But Biden is an old guy. In his continuation, he was a vice president under Obama, and that will continue. So I agree with Christoph. Russia will outlive this, and I think we'll have to wait to another president to start seeing things differently.
Now, Christoph, Washington imposes new sanctions on Russia at the same time it claims that it wants to work with Moscow over Iran and North Korea, for instance. What's the U.S. Policy vis-a-vis Russia?
The problem is with them, they have, as Vladimir rightly put it, a very old-fashioned way of showing off about policy. We know what this is. This is a kowtow that is bowing down to the American deep state, especially if it comes to Iran, of course, because this deep state is, you know, Zionist rule, and there are Zionists of this kind. I would say, for example, the owners of the New York Times, they are somehow moderates, but there are others who are a lot crazier than this one. And again, how to say, this American government is very strongly moving against Iran. What we see here is a provocation, for example, with this stupid vessel in the Persian Gulf, where Iran is truly, I must laugh when I think about it, accused of attacking this vessel, which is belonging to a close friend of the Mossad boss. Yeah? It is very obviously for anybody who is 3 or 5 days in politics that Iran would not, you know, give the Israelis such an advantage as to attacking this ship. But in fact, if we listen to Tel Aviv, you know, and you own a vessel, and this is running around the Persian Gulf, the best thing, if you get any damage, is strictly advisable to talk to Tel Aviv directly and ask the Israelis to, you know, pay the damage. I think that is the most intelligent thing to do. So the U.S. is, in fact, in a very bad flow right now, because the so-called anti-Trump mood they have to serve, that is, of course, you know, the theater we are being played every day. That is a deep state theater. Biden has no, you know, force whatsoever. He's not being forced to do anything bad against Russia or anything stupid against Iran. No need for that. He could very clearly, you know, open discussion and talk sense and not talk preconditions when the U.S., for example, never fulfilled the JCPOA, the nuclear deal, and Iran also always overdid it by 105%. So this is totally crazy what we have right now in the situation. Washington's, in fact, isolating itself in a very crazy way, and okay. I do understand that Biden is not the leading person. But
okay, Crystal, I have to jump in. Unfortunately, we're out of time. Sorry for cutting you. We're out of time. That's all the time we had. So let me thank our guests. We had veteran journalist and political activist Christoph Forstall from Berlin and lecturer with Brown University Vladimir Goldstein, who joined us out of Rhode Island with his contribution. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi, and I'll see you next time.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The U.S.'s billionaires have amassed democracy-distorting concentration of wealth and power as millions have been thrown into poverty, says Chuck Collins, writer, in an article published under the heading, COVID-19 has exacerbated extreme levels of inequality. It's time for a billionaire wealth tax. Here's more. What should good societies do when a wealthy few reap enormous financial windfalls during a global pandemic? While millions lost their lives, livelihoods, health, and wealth, the world's billionaires and super-rich prospered. According to research from Americans for Tax Fairness and the Institute for Policy Studies, between March 18, 2020 and February 19, 2021, the combined wealth of U.S. billionaires increased by $1.3 trillion, a 44.6% increase in space of just 48 weeks. The concentration of wealth is staggering. There are now 661 billionaires in the U.S. with a total wealth of $4.26 trillion as of February 19, 2021, up from $2.9 trillion on March 18, 2020, nearly a year earlier. For perspective, the combined wealth of the bottom half of all U.S. households, 165 million people, is $2.4 trillion, according to the Federal Reserve. Elon Musk's wealth grew by an astounding $157 billion from $24.6 billion on March 18, 2020, to $182 billion on February 19, 2021, a nearly seven-fold increase boosted by the rapid increase in the value of Tesla stock. Jeff Bezos's wealth grew from $113 billion to $189 billion over the same period, an increase of almost 60%. Mark Zuckerberg's wealth grew from $54.7 billion to $95.7 billion, fueled by his ownership of Facebook. Dan Gilbert, chairman of Quicken Loans, saw his wealth skyrocket by 559% from $6.5 billion in March 2020 to $42.8 billion on February 19, 2021. These are democracy-distorting levels of concentrated wealth and power, and many of these billionaires control powerful companies with the ability, especially during the pandemic, to consolidate their market share and monopoly power over large sections of the U.S. and global economy. Amazon, Walmart, and Target have all benefited from having their main street competition effectively shuttered under the artificial economic conditions of the pandemic. The wealthy do not always benefit during economic adversity. In the aftermath of 2008 recession, U.S. billionaires saw their fortunes decline along with anyone else's. It wasn't until almost 4 years later, in September 2012, that the total wealth of the Forbes 400 exceeded its pre-2008 recession levels. While some increases in billionaire assets mirror the overall rise in stock markets, the largest gains reflect their ownership stakes in powerful companies that have taken the advantage of temporary monopoly and home isolation conditions created by the pandemic. Online retail, restaurant and food delivery apps, telemedicine, big pharma, and video conferencing have all reaped windfalls from the unusual pandemic economy. Of the roughly 56 new billionaires that emerged over 2020, many are associated with initial public offerings at companies like DoorDash, Airbnb, and Snowflake. These unseemly inequalities are the context for a debate over who should pay for trillion-dollar COVID recovery packages. While politicians of all persuasions have largely avoided talking about how to pay for the trillions in deficit spending over 2020, the moment has now arrived. Around the world, countries are considering wealth taxes on surging billionaire assets as one source. Argentina and Bolivia are both considering wealth taxes to help pay for economic recovery. Times of war and crisis in the U.S. have historically led to the institution of more progressive tax systems, including the conspiration of wealth to pay the bills. In 1862, the U.S. established an inheritance tax to help pay for the Civil War. Levies on inheritances and estates appeared during the Spanish-American War and First World War, finally being codified in 1916 with permanent federal income and estate taxes. In July 2020, several U.S. senators introduced the Make Billionaires Pay Act levy on a one-time 60% pandemic wealth tax on billionaire gains over 2020. By one estimate, this would have raised $420 billion for a health care provision. Several states, including California and Washington State, have legislation pending to institute a wealth tax and make their state's taxes more progressive with higher rates on billionaires. Senator Elizabeth Warren is going to introduce an updated version of her wealth tax proposal. Warren's initial proposal was an annual wealth tax on households, with wealth starting at $50 million, roughly the 100,000 wealthiest households in the U.S. The 2% annual levy would increase to 6% on every dollar of net worth above $1 billion. The proposal would raise almost $4 trillion over the next 10 years. A tax that exempts 99.9% of taxpayers, yet raises substantial revenue from billionaires, is good politics and policy. While members of Congress might be divided over a wealth tax, polls over the past 2 years indicate wide public support for taxing the wealthy. An annual tax on wealth will require a new set of implementation rules. In the meantime, Congress can move quickly to restore progress to the U.S. tax code, a system that has seen tax rates paid by billionaires erode over the last half century. One proposal is to institute a millionaire surtax, a 10% income tax surcharge on incomes over $3 million, whether from capital or wages. This would raise $660 billion over the next decade entirely from households in the top 0.1% and move Americans closer to a fairer system that eliminates the preferential tax treatment of income from capital over income, from wages and work. None of these proposals will succeed unless the U.S. shuts down the tax loop.